Let me open us with a word of prayer. I know Tyler prayed, but I'm going to pray too. Bow your heads. Father, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for a day that we can come and worship and celebrate who you are. And God, I ask that in our hearts that we would be just prepared to enjoy this time of church gathering, this time of fellowship, this time of community, and that you would speak to us, that you would change us, and that we would leave here different than we were, than we walked in. In Jesus' name, amen. In my family, I do all the grocery shopping. Kristen doesn't like to go to the grocery store. I love going to the grocery store. I know a lot of people hate it, but no, I love going to the food line right around the corner from my house. I go in and I make it an event. I don't rush through like a lot of people do, just like trucking through with their cart. I go through, I get a bottle of water, I get some chips, I get a candy bar, leave it all spread out in the front, and just enjoy my time as I'm perusing the aisles. I figure if I have to be there once, twice a week, I'm going to have a good time with it. And so I'm walking through the aisles, and I go through the produce, and I have my system as I do it. I watch the people, I read the back of boxes, even though I don't really care about fat content and things like that. I still do it just because I have the time. And so I'm walking through the aisles, and I get to what is my favorite aisle. My favorite aisle is by far the cereal aisle. I'm like a big kid. And actually, being a big kid is a good, apt representation of what happened the other day. I was at the grocery store, and this woman turns onto the cereal aisle while I'm there. I'm deciding between the Lucky Charms and the Honey Bunches of Oats with strawberries. Now, just for reference, if you do get the Honey Bunches of Oats with strawberries, don't get the Food Lion brand because they don't give you a lot of strawberries. You have to buy extra strawberries to put them in. That's not really relevant to the message, but I thought you would like to know. So I'm trying to decide between those two boxes of cereal, and this woman turns with one of those carts with the steering wheels for her kids, and she has two kids in the cart that are steering the little thing, and she turns in, and immediately I think to myself, rookie mistake. And it's because anybody without kids would know, you don't take young children on the candy aisle at the grocery store. I mean, that would just be stupid. You take a kid on the candy aisle, and they're going to go nuts. Everybody knows this. But what a lot of people don't realize, what a lot of new parents wouldn't realize, or people who don't have kids wouldn't realize, is the candy aisle isn't even the bad aisle. The bad aisle is the cereal aisle. Every parent knows this. The cereal aisle is colorful. It has not just cereal. It has juice. It has fruit snacks. It has granola bars. It has juice boxes, not only juice, but juice boxes. And they put toys on that aisle because they know what's going on. And so this woman makes the rookie mistake of turning onto that aisle, and immediately her kids do what kids do on that aisle. I want, I need, I have to have. And the mother just loses it. She realizes what she's done. Right, I mean, she's 2 feet in, but there's nothing you can do at this point. And so she just starts yelling back at her kids, no, no, you have it at home, you don't need any more, we're getting oat bran. And the word oat bran sets the kids off, and they're like, you don't love me. If you loved me, you would let me have whatever. And the woman goes crazy, I mean, not like literally crazy, but she says, if you guys don't calm down, we are going to go home and you will be in timeout for the rest of your lives. And this whole time, the minute the woman turned onto the aisle, I stopped looking at the cereal, and I just kind of turned and started watching. And it wasn't like a subtle kind of like up, you know, side glance. It was like a very blatant, like just kind of watching. And remember, this is me with a bottle of water and chips and a candy bar. Like she has become my entertainment for the day. And this woman turns in, and the minute she gets to the point and says, we are going to go home and you will be in timeout for the rest of your lives, I'm standing here with a candy bar going, whew! And immediately all three of them stop. The kids stop crying, the woman stops yelling, all three of them in unison stop, they turn and they look at me and their heads tilt to the side like dogs when they're watching you pee, as if to say, what makes you think you can do that in here? And so, I try to fix it and I say, and you guys be the judge, I think I have a good excuse. I actually say to the woman, I say, it's okay, I have kids. As if to say, this is my excuse for you being my entertainment. I have children, therefore I can do this. And none of them say a word to me. It's like the youngest kid just shakes his head. And they back out of the aisle and leave. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm the jerk. I must be the jerk. And in hindsight, though, my excuse is valid. My excuse is right. I do have kids. And in my head, what I'm thinking is that she and I were the same. If I had my two children with me on this aisle, they would be doing the exact same thing. I would be doing the exact same thing. We are kindred spirits, she and I, and all I'm doing is highlighting the common ground between us. Now, of course, she didn't see it the same way, But we do this. I think this is natural. I'm an introvert. I'd rather be by myself than with people. But when I'm around strangers, it is a natural function of the human soul to look for common ground. And that's what I did with this woman. I saw something in common, and so I connected with her in the only way I could. Now, of course, she hated that she had become my entertainment, but whatever. Everybody gets this. If you've ever been to a Mexican food restaurant with a big group of people, you always have that one person at the table who has to like use the four Spanish words they know. The waiter walks up and they're like, hola. And like the waiter just shakes his head. You know, he know, like he gets that every table he goes to, hola. And he's like, hola, you know, that's all he does. And then it gets worse. You have the one guy who like went to Cancun for spring break one year. And he's like, yo quiero tacos. And like, that's the best he could do. And I'm like, man, it's kind of turned you a little bit into a racist too. And you know, it's really hard for Kristen and I, because Kristen actually lived in Mexico for over a year, and I lived there for a few months. And so, you know, we go into a Mexican food restaurant, and we do feel like, man, I would love to talk to these people about their culture, about, you know, being from Mexico. And so one of us, it's not uncommon to say, de donde eres, where are you from? And, you know, in hopes to start a conversation about something that we loved so much. And on more than one occasion, they will say, you know, I'm from Winston-Salem, you know, like, and you're just like, all right, I'm the jerk, you know, oops, you know, but it all stems from the same thing. Like, we want to connect to a stranger. Like, we want to find that common ground and bridge the gap. We even do it with inanimate objects. I mean, everybody's gone on a long, maybe not, maybe this is just me. I'll go on a long trip and a car will let me merge. And like immediately I think to myself, this guy likes me. And you know, the car will be with me for like 100 miles down the road. And you know, you pass him, he passes you, and you realize, man, this guy's been with me a long time. And you kind of become friends, not even with the driver, but with the car. The car becomes special to you. And then when he exits, you feel like a piece of you is missing. I mean, maybe I'm alone on that, but it's this desire for connection, even though I don't even really like people all that much. And so, you know, I don't know what it is. I have to believe that it's part of the human soul. So in one hand, there's a big part of us that wants to connect. But simultaneously, while this part of us is going on, there is a whole nother part of us that wants to push people away. And I asked a lot of people yesterday, and I'll ask you guys kind of generally, think about this yourselves. If I said to all of you, I want you to go out and hold auditions, and you have to find someone who's going to be a friend of yours for the rest of your life, what kind of characteristics, personality traits, whatever, would exclude a person from being able to be that friend for you? And man, I asked people yesterday, and they're, I mean, just ripping things off. Like, if they smell too bad, if they're too tall, I mean, like, anything. Like, people are picky. And that's what happens, is when we all of a sudden think about who are we going to truly let in, suddenly we don't naturally have that bridge anymore. That bridge kind of falls down. When we think about who are we really going to let into our lives, we become very picky. I thought about my list of what would exclude a person from being a really good friend of mine. And my list is pretty long. It's one-uppers, people who have to do one thing better than you, me monsters, vegans, baby talkers, people who talk like a baby but there's no babies around, that drives me crazy. Competitive parents, I get it, your kid speaks 12 languages, good for you. Double dippers, that's just gross. Even if we're not gonna be friends, you shouldn't do this. It's like me having to take my chip and dip it directly into the salsa in your mouth. That's not cool. People who are too negative, but also people who are too positive, you know, I can't really deal with that. People who are touchy and have to hug me all the time, no thank you. People who aren't humble like I am, name droppers, extreme couponers, gossips, of course. People who talk during movies, people who use their cell phone during movies, people who chew their popcorn too loudly during movies. The correct way to eat your popcorn in movies is not by getting it by the fistful and shoving it into your mouth. It's one piece of popcorn, you set it on your tongue, let it dissolve a little bit, and it slides right down the way it's supposed to go. It's amazing that I have any friends at all. But I do. I do have friends, at least I think I do. I think I have friends. And the reason I have friends is not because my friends don't do these things. The reason I have friends is because I don't care. I don't care that they do these things. I overlook them. And it occurred to me recently that the person that I'm most connected to in the world, and this is where things get dangerous, does one of these things. My wife, whom I love, again, this is where things get dangerous, is guilty of one of these things. She is a loud chewer. I love her. We've been married 10 years this October. I love her so much. She is beautiful. She is kind. She is small and petite, but somehow when she starts eating food, she is like a lioness ripping into a gazelle. Like, it is like into it. Like, she eats loud. And I remember when we first got together, that's what it was like. But now, 10 years later, it occurred to me, I don't even really notice it that way anymore. She's like a little cute squirrel. Like, you know, it's much more like that. And it's not that things have changed. It's that I have learned to overlook. It's that the traits that would drive me crazy in one person, I completely overlook in someone that I love. Today, we're talking about community. We're talking about church love. We're talking about community love. We're talking about connecting with people in a way that we get past the kinds of things that would pull us apart and, in fact, actually connect ourselves together. And I believe that everyone in this room wants to love and to be loved. I think everybody in this room wants to know people, like truly know people, and also to be known. And I think every person in this room wants to experience the kind of church community that God would intend for us. I think that we just do. 1 Thessalonians 2:8, Paul is talking to the Thessalonian church, and he says, "We delighted in you guys so much that we shared not only the gospel of Christ, but we shared our very lives." And that word lives, life, is the Greek word suche. And that word suche does not refer to the time spent between birth and death. That word suche is referring to the very essence of a person, the very soul of a person, sharing absolutely everything about yourself with another person. 1 Thessalonians is a reference of Paul, but also a challenge for us to share every part of ourselves with someone else. When we were trying to get pregnant the first time, we told people that we were trying to get pregnant. And when Kristen finally did get pregnant with Nolan, I mean, the stick wasn't even dry and we were on the phone. Like, we were calling everybody. We were calling family, friends. We were calling everybody in the world to tell them we are pregnant. And a really well-intentioned friend let us know pretty early on. They came to us and they said, you know, we're thrilled for you guys, but we want to let you know that it's not completely uncommon for people to lose the baby really early on in pregnancies. And so you may want to hold off on telling people, at least for a time. A lot of people choose to do that. And we weren't aware of this. We didn't know this. And so Kristen and I had a conversation about it, and we talked about it, and completely respecting people who do choose to wait to tell people, we decided not to. We decided we were going to go on telling everybody that we were pregnant, even though we had only known for a little while. And the reason was simple. The reason was that if these are people that we care so much about that we're going to ask them to celebrate the good times with us, we want to invite them in to grieve with us in the hard times too. In case something bad happened, if they're good enough to celebrate, they're good enough to grieve. We shared with everyone because we wanted to invite people into every part of our lives. We were, like Paul, delighted to share everything. Every seventh day, Christians gather together to share the most important thing in their life. We celebrate everything God is and everything he does. We talk about worship and discipleship and everything within these walls that just surrounds the person of Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit. That's what we do every seventh day. This is our community. This is our church. This is our faith community. We make big promises here. You know, we do a membership class where we talk about what is gained and had and being part of specifically even this faith community. But every faith community makes big promises. Every faith community promises not only a connection with God, but a connection with other people. And this is a very, very big promise. Recently, Nolan brought home from school the book, The Emperor's New Clothes. And I like this book. It's a lot of fun to read it. I read it again this morning. And it's about this emperor who loved clothing more than anything. He's a lot like a pastor we know. And it just occurred to me as I'm going through this. This emperor loved clothing so much. And so while other emperors were spending their time with politics and other things, he pursued clothing. And then he came across these two wicked men, these thieves, who told him, they're like, we can weave and put together this fine clothing, this fine garment that is amazing and beautiful. You've never seen anything like it. And the thing is about it, only stupid people can't see it. Only people who are fit for office, only smart people can see it. And so if people can't see it, it means they're stupid. And so the emperor was thrilled by this idea, not only with the beautiful fabric, the beautiful clothes, but also the ability to tell, hey, who's stupid and who's not? And so he commissioned the men to weave a garment for him. And after a little bit of time, he sent in one person who he trusted to go see what it looks like. And the first guy walks in and sees these two guys pretending to weave a garment while in reality they were hiding all the fabric to steal it. And this first guy walks in and he sees nothing and he's terrified. And he says, does this mean I'm stupid? And so he walks back out and he says, I saw it. It's beautiful. It's amazing. Everything they said it's going to be, it is fantastic. Some more time passes and the emperor sends in another trusty guy. And that guy walks in and he thinks to himself, I see nothing. This is terrible. What does this mean? And so he walks back out and he tells the emperor, it's amazing. It's beautiful. It's everything that they promised. And finally, the emperor himself walks in and sees them pretending to work and thinks to himself, I see no garment. Does this mean I am unfit for my job? Does this mean I'm stupid? And so out of fear of being stupid, he doesn't say a word, but instead pretends to see what they're telling him he should see. And we know how this story goes. And in the end, he's walking through the streets in a processional, buck naked. And every person in the town is pretending to see this garment because that's what they've been told they should see, until an innocent little kid steps up and says, hey, are we going to all pretend this guy's not naked? And then like a veil, it lifts and they all laugh and realize we've been deceived. We've been lied to. We make huge, huge promises in the church. And nobody would want to believe that the promise of community, the promise of human connection, is not everything that we're saying it should be within these four walls. We really want to believe that we look splendid. But is there something that we notice in a lot of churches, perhaps even at times here, that we don't want to say or speak up about for fear that it reflects poorly on us? The average American has two people that they would refer to as a close friend. Two people. That is not a high number, and it's lower now than it's ever been. It used to be three, but in the last 15, 20 years, it's dropped down to two. That number is shrinking. George Barna says, we are among the loneliest people in the world. The problem that we have in our world, in our culture, in the church, the problem that we have is actually the oldest problem in human history. It is older than sin. Genesis 2:18 says, it is not good for man to be alone. The problem that we have is that we are lonelier than we have ever been in human history. And you may think to yourself, well, I'm not alone. I have Awestruck. I have 100 plus people every single week in my life around me. I am by no means alone, but in the 21st century, it is completely possible to have people all around us and to be completely alone and to not have community. We have what is called crowded loneliness in our culture today. Crowded loneliness is people who are all around you, who see you, but don't know you. People who are around you that you don't know and who don't know you. We have a problem surrounded by people, but we have still managed to hole up and be completely alone. How did this happen? Well, there's a lot of reasons why this has happened, but I thought about three major reasons that I think this happens for the American church and for our culture in general. The first one is that we're hypocrites. In ancient Greece, actors wore masks, and this is where we get the term hypocrite. Now, hypocrite simply means a mask wearer. Now, what we tend to think when we hear that word hypocrite is this strong, passionate, negative connotation of someone who says one thing to deceive us and conceal a life of sin, but that's not really what the word means. What the word really means is not someone who conceals sin, but really someone who conceals themselves. I have a friend who is a youth pastor in Mount Airy, and he actually had to end a game for his youth. Now, I think this is pretty common among youth groups, like games will get out of hand, and so they have to put the kibosh on it. Well, he had to put the kibosh on hide and seek. Hide and seek simply got out of hand for him. And he has this slightly larger church, and it was an old church building, and he had this one particular youth who would come in and they would do hide and seek on their lock-ins where they would lock the door and the kids would just stay there all night long. And this one kid would go and he would hide and they could not find this kid, like ever. Like this kid had this problem. He wasn't like narcoleptic, but he might as well have been, because he would go and he would hide in some little hole somewhere and he would fall asleep. And he was an incredibly deep sleeper. And on more than one occasion, my friend had to call the kid's mother and say, your kid's here. We know he's here. The doors are locked, but we have no idea where this kid is. And so time would come where people would come and pick up their kids, and he would be sleeping somewhere. They would yell his name, but the kid would not come out until he woke up and chose to come out. And so he actually had to end hide and seek. And my friend and I were talking about this one day, and we realized, man, this is a really good picture of how most people treat church. Like people come within the four walls of the church, and they sit there, and they hide, and eventually we hope that they will come out and reveal themselves to the community around them. But it's completely up to them. There's nothing that a pastor or a friend or a fellow congregant can do to make a person really show themselves. You could be here forever hiding within these four walls, never really letting anybody know who you truly are. This happened to me just in the last 2 weeks. This is a really hard story for me to tell. A friend of mine, a guy that I've known for, 14, 15 years, I knew him in and out of my life. I haven't really talked to him in the last 2 years, but for a while, he was coming to the church plant that I started in Reedy Fork. He came for over 2.5 years, this guy. I knew him. I hung out with him once or twice a week. Every time our doors were open, he was there within the four walls of the church. This guy was as connected as anybody could be to a church during that period of 2.5 years. Last week, he was arrested for child pornography. And I had no idea, did not see that coming. And my first thought was, what could I have done? You know, like there had to have been something. I was the guy's pastor. 2.5 years, I was that guy's pastor. Like, where did I fail? Where did I drop the ball? What could I have done so that this didn't happen? And Josh and I talked about it, and he had really good words about it. And the reality was, he could have been coming for 2.5 years, 5 years, 10 years. I can't come down from the stage. Josh can't walk across the aisle and rip somebody's mask off for them. We can't do it. You can be whoever you want to be within these four walls. It is completely up to you to take the mask off. But as long as you're committed to hiding behind something, you will always be alone. The problem that we have is that we find ourselves alone in a culture despite being surrounded by people. And it's because a lot of times we are committed to concealing who we really are. Second thing that we do that tends to set us apart is we tend to focus on our differences rather than what unites us. Every church that I've ever been in, all four of them, when I've been a college pastor, a youth pastor, a lead pastor, and now an associate pastor, I have heard in some variation the words, I just don't have anything in common with the people there. Wherever I've been, I've heard some variation of that. They're either too old or too young, and they love this too much, or they like this too much. And so because I don't have anything in common, I'm going to try this church or this place and see if I have something more in common with the people down there. And I want to grab them by the shoulders and shake them and say, you have the most important thing in the world in common with these people. Don't you see that? I mean, Josh and I are two of the most different people in the world. Look at his beard. This is a month and a half for me. Like, that alone is a physical representation of how different we are. He likes to hunt. I have never, literally, never held a gun in my life. He likes to go into the Grand Canyon. I like to go to New York City. Josh and I are very, very different people. But if we made a list of the most important things in our lives, the top two of the top three things on our list we have in common. Like, his family and my family are interchangeable. But the other two things, God and awestruck, are both at the top of our list. Everything else, hunting, New York City, Grand Canyon, that's down here. Everything that we really, truly love that make us who we are, Josh and I have in common. And if we're focusing so much on this extra stuff that we say, well, we really don't have anything to talk about, maybe we're spending too much time talking about the wrong things. If you really feel like in a church, I don't have anything to talk about with these people, maybe you're talking about the wrong thing with them. Because for most of us, if you're in these walls and you love Jesus and you're here at awestruck, the top of your list should really look the same. You got a lot to talk about. In Matthew 12, 46 through 50, there is this passage that is really fascinating. Jesus is talking to the multitudes and he's teaching them and just hanging out with them. And somebody walks up and he says, your mother and your brothers are outside. And Jesus says, who are my mother and my brothers but those who do the will of God? I want to read it quite literally in 49 and 50. He stretched out his hand toward his disciples and said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and my sister and my mother. Jesus is redefining the most basic community element in this moment. He is saying more important than sharing a last name, more important than sharing blood, is sharing a purpose, sharing God's purpose. Family, community at a basic level are those who share a purpose, those who commit themselves to something. It's not something you're born into. It's not something you move into. And it's most certainly not something you schedule into your week. Community is a commitment between two people with a common love. That's what Jesus is saying in Matthew 12. We tend to focus on what divides us rather than what unites us. And as long as we do that, we will forever be alone. We will be surrounded by people, but we will be alone. And the last thing is that we're afraid to be vulnerable sometimes. There is a children's story called The Velveteen Rabbit. And I want to read a dialogue between the old worn-out horse and the rabbit that is in this pursuit to become real. The skin horse had lived longer in the nursery than any of the others. He was so old that his brown coat was bald in patches and showed the seams underneath, and most of the hairs in his tail had been pulled out to string bead necklaces. He was wise, for he had seen a long succession of mechanical toys arrive to boast and swagger and by break their mainsprings and pass away. And he knew they were only toys and would never turn into anything else, for nursery magic is a very strange and wonderful thing, and only those playthings that are old and wise and experienced, like the skin horse, understand all about it. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day, when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside of you and stick out and handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It is a thing that happens to you when a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you. Then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "But when you are real, you don't mind being hurt." We have to be at a place where we are okay to be hurt if we are truly going to have the kind of community God has for us. In Acts 2:42, it says that the disciples devoted themselves to the fellowship. That word fellowship is koinonia. And koinonia means more than just shaking a hand and saying hello on a Sunday morning. Koinonia is companionship, it's sharing, but most specifically, koinonia is being intimately connected with another person. What is had among the early Christians is a risky kind of love. It's a kind of love that extends themselves out in a very real way and says, "Do you accept me for who I am?" That is koinonia. Let me just simply ask a question. Within these four walls, who is a person that could hurt you? Not say something that would make you mad or offend you, but who is someone who could really hurt you? If the answer is nobody, if you're one of those people that could say, "Man, nobody can hurt me," well, good for you, but that means you don't have community. If you are incapable of being hurt, it may be comfortable, but it's not community. It is extremely easy to live behind a mask. It's extremely easy to focus on what separates us, and it is extremely easy to live without being able to be hurt, but it is not good for man to be alone, and make no mistake, these things make us alone. Loneliness is the problem. Community is the solution. In the Psalms, there is a psalm that is very beautiful. It's Psalm 133, and if you have a Bible, go ahead and turn there. In Psalm 133, we are in the latter portion of the book of Psalms, the collection of the Psalms, and these Psalms are known as Songs of Ascent. Now, this latter portion of the Psalms were sung as people would journey towards Jerusalem. People would walk towards Jerusalem to celebrate the festivals, to go for different reasons, but they would almost always go as a community, as a family, as a community element. And as they would head towards Jerusalem, which was literally at an altitude higher than many of the surrounding areas, they would sing these songs of ascent as they were ascending. And as they would do this, they would celebrate these songs of ascent. These songs of ascent were celebrations of their history. They were a celebration of what God has done, their prosperity, their peace, the rescue that God provided all of the times throughout their history. That's what the songs of ascent did. They celebrated what God had done. And in Psalm 133, we see that again in something else that God did for the people. Psalm 133. "Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. It is like precious oil upon the head running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the edge of his garments. It is like the dew of Hermon descending upon the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord commanded blessing, life evermore." This is a short psalm, but this is beautiful. This is poetry at its finest. Psalm 133 is a beautiful, beautiful celebration of something God had done. He had provided community. It starts off very simple. How good and pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity. How great it is when we have community. That's how it starts. It is a wonderful thing when we have community. And then it gets very poetic. It is like oil on Aaron's head, on the beard of Aaron. Now, this is a reference to the high priest, the anointing of the high priest, quite literally, the anointing of the person in the community who is there by design to look out for the people. This is saying, quite literally, that community is so wonderful because it's like having someone who is there to look out for you all of the time. Then he goes on and says, it is like the dew on Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon was a high place north of Israel that provided water to the people all year long. Again, it's saying community is so wonderful because it is the provision of a human need constantly. This psalm is a worship psalm. It is a celebration psalm. They are worshiping that God has provided for them something that they needed so much, community. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "It is grace, nothing but grace, that we are allowed to live in community." Genesis 2:18, "It is not good for man to be alone." Primarily because we're just not good people when we're alone. We're coming to the end here, but I want to highlight two things. When we are alone, we tend to overlook our shortcomings. Now, we've talked about this before, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but community by design cleans us up. When I was in college, I had, gosh, this is a little bit gross. I was told how gross this is after last service. I didn't wash my socks. Now, you know, I go barefoot a lot now, but back in college, I wore shoes more, and I would play basketball, I would play racquetball, I would walk around the campus, and I would just get back to my apartment, and I would take off my socks, and I would put them right back in the drawer. And gosh, now I'm 33 years old and right, like reflecting, and I'm just like, wow, how did I find a wife? And then the thing is, I would pull the sock back out and I would put them back on my feet, and then I would get back home and I would put them back in the drawer. And so it wasn't like a one-time thing. It was like I never washed my socks. Like, I guess maybe I heard that you lose them in the wash, and I was like, uh-uh, not me. I'm not going to lose them. And so instead, I had socks that were literally, I mean, they were brown. Like, they turned brown, and they were crusty, and you could hold them, and they would be, like, solid. And, like, you would have to break them for these socks. And then I got married, and I haven't had brown socks in 10 years. Like, she killed that right away. Like, she does not let me have brown socks. And it is because Kristen is there to take care of the nasty parts of me. Like, that is what community is. People, by design, who are close to you do not let you be nasty. If you have people in your life who care about you, this person should be fixing you. They should be looking at the parts of you that they're just like, man, that's gross, man. You just need to fix that. Now, we're talking about socks here, but also personality traits. I mean, all of those things in the beginning, if you're a me monster, if you're, arrogance came up so many times when I said, who is a person that you just could not hang out with? Everybody said, arrogant or drama queen, something like that. We know people like that, though. What they need is somebody to get in their life and say, man, you like drama too much. People don't like you because of it. That's community. Now, you need to approach it the right way, but ask yourself, when was the last time someone pointed out a problem of mine? And if it's really hard to think of a time, your community might be broken. Now, it could be because you're unapproachable. It could be because your friends are kind of afraid to do something they don't see a lot of people do. But somehow it's up to us to cultivate an environment where people can speak truth into our lives. That's what community does. Biblical community, by design, cleans us up. And the other thing it does is it pushes us to places we otherwise wouldn't go by ourselves. I've been running for about 6 months now. And I was running a mile for a while, and then all of a sudden, a few people, actually a person in the church, Phil Verkommert, and one of my neighbors, both kind of at about the same time, said, that's great that you can run a mile, but you really need to start extending for distance. And I just hadn't thought about it before because I didn't want to. And so I started running farther, and I've been doing that for a while. And about a month ago, I ran a 5K in 33 minutes. And when I ran it in 33 minutes, I got home and I said, I have reached the peak of human evolution. Human evolution cannot go faster than 33 minutes in a 5K. And I told my community group, I was like, I'm so proud. I have done what Usain Bolt and any other runner could do. I have run the 5K in the 33-minute time that is the peak of human evolution. And the next day, Vicky, who is in my community group, she asked me to go running with her. And that day, I ran it in 31:47, something like that. And at the end, I almost threw up. This was the first time I was like, all right, just give me a minute, you know? But I looked at the time, and I realized that just running next to somebody, she wasn't pushing, she wasn't yelling in my ear, just running next to somebody made me faster. It made me better, just having someone next. She said, man, you were really pushing at the beginning, and I said, I thought you were pushing. And neither one of us were intentionally trying to make the other one go faster. We just both ran faster because someone was running next to us. That's what biblical community does. Proverbs 27:17, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Community by design makes us better people. But it isn't natural. We want it. There's something inside of us that desperately wants to connect. But at the same time, there is something inside of us that desperately wants to push people away. It's not natural. Loving and being loved is not easy, and knowing and being known is not something that comes real easy to us. It is hard work. But in community, the pursuit of knowing people, we are practicing for eternity. As we close, I want to read a quote by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis says of community. He says of love. To love it all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers of love is hell.